Should be cloudy and mild, 30% chance of rain with scattered fog this morning, and a high of 53 degrees inland, a little bit cooler near Lake Michigan. Here are the current numbers. Under a cloudy gray sky, it is 43 degrees in Racine, 44 this morning for Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News Time, 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we are discussing a very important topic which has figured so prominently in the history of the United States. In some respects, it fully embodies the history of the United States, and that's one of the challenges about writing about it and talking about it in sufficiently comprehensive fashion. We're going to be talking about immigration and immigrants, and particularly the way in which immigrants have figured so prominently in the shaping of the United States as we know it, and in particular, some of the terrible struggles which immigrants have experienced at the hands of Americans themselves, sometimes even other immigrant groups. It has been a turbulent time, and that picture of the melting pot of all kinds of different ethnic groups coming together, amalgamating into this amazing United States of America, also speaks of turbulence and sometimes great tensions, sometimes existing just beneath the surface and sometimes very much boiling over in outbreaks of violence and destruction. It is a history which is not always comfortable to read and to reflect upon. But there it is, inescapable, really. And one of the most interesting ways in which one can come to terms with the experience that immigrants have had throughout American history is with a new book called Immigrant Struggles, Immigrant Gifts. The book is given under the auspices of something called the Immigrant Learning Center, which our guest on the morning show, Diane Portnoy, helped to create several years ago to provide intensive English instruction to new arrivals in her town of Malden, Massachusetts, where she and her parents had settled when they immigrated to the United States just after World War II. And Diane Portnoy and her husband, Barry, have cared deeply about the issue of immigration and the plight of immigrants for a long, long time. Again, this book is called Immigrant Struggles, Immigrant Gifts. And Diane Portnoy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tell us a little more, if you would, about your own personal experience, that is, as an immigrant, when your family came to the United States and under what circumstances?
Well, my parents were Polish Jews who survived the Holocaust but lost their entire families. I was born a year after World War II ended in what became East Germany. And when I was a few months old, it became very dangerous for Jewish people to remain there as Russians took over. And so my parents paid somebody to hide us in the back of a truck And we escaped to West Germany. I guess you would quote-unquote call us illegal at that time, but my parents were looking to survive. Then in 1948, the United States passed the Displaced Persons Act, and this allowed 450,000 visas to those people that were displaced during World War II, and about 190,000 of them went to Jews. So my parents applied. It was a visa process, a lottery. My parents applied, and we were chosen. We came to the United States on a converted battleship. The government brought us, men on one side of the boat, women and children on the other. I was very, very sick. And when we landed at Ellis Island, I was quarantined. My mother and I were quarantined for over a week. Obviously, I got better. My father found out there was this community in Malden, Massachusetts. There was a factory there that was hiring people. And we moved to Malden, Massachusetts. I grew up in a community in Malden at that time that was made up primarily of immigrants, Holocaust survivors. So, you see, I saw firsthand their strength, their courage, their resilience. I saw the work ethic. I saw people starting businesses. Of all my parents' friends, my parents were the only ones that found each other after World War II. Every other person I knew had lost a spouse and children during World War II. And somehow they got married again, they started new families, and they started new lives. And I found this amazing. And they made good lives for themselves and for their children. All the children went to college, universities, became professionals. I watched them learn the language. It was not easy. I watched them learn a new culture. And then when I started the Immigrant Learning Center 20 years ago, I've been seeing the same thing over and over again. Now, in 1992, when I opened the school, our students were primarily from Eastern Europe because the wall had come down, and from Vietnam. Today, we see many students from Haiti because of the earthquake 2 years ago. We see many, many people from the Middle East, China. They're really from all over the world. But you see the faces change. The stories don't change. The drive, the desire, the hope, all that still remains the same.
Hmm. Could you explain why Malden, Massachusetts? That is, was there any particular reason why Malden, Massachusetts, as you describe it, was a particularly welcoming place for immigrants?
You know, this particular community, which is 6 miles north of Boston, has a long history of welcoming immigrants, you know, different immigrant groups over the years. It has, you know, there was a time there were Irish, there were Italians, the Jews that came in after World War II. It just was a welcoming community, and there were, at that time, there were factories in Malden, so people could find jobs. And as I said, my parents found out through various organizations that there was a Jewish community there, the work could be found, and that's where we settled.
Mm. Now, when you settled in Malden, Massachusetts, and you say your parents set about the hard task of learning a new language, the language of English, how did they do it back then?
You know, that is a wonderful question, and I'm still amazed. I think they did it, they would listen to radio, they would watch TV, they worked, so they learned it from the other workers, and they were just so determined to learn the language.
So it was largely their own sort of individual effort.
There were no free schools. There was no immigrant learning center. There were no free schools. There certainly was no money to pay for school. For many, many years, I translated. I learned English quickly. You know, I was 3 and a half, 4 years old. I went to school right away and learned the language quickly. And there were years that I would translate for them. But they did learn the language, and it was, you know, interacting with others. And again, I tell students this too. I say, listen to the radio and watch television, because you'll keep hearing and seeing the language that way.
And Malden, Massachusetts remains a welcoming place for immigrants?
Yes, it is an incredibly diverse community. Almost half of our students at the Immigrant Learning Center actually are from Malden. The rest come from surrounding communities in the Boston area. There's public transportation that brings them there. And yes, it's very diverse. The school has, last year we had students from over 60 countries.
Wow.
Speaking 48, I think, different first languages.
Very good.
It's very, very diverse. And it's wonderful to walk into a classroom because each class has 20 students. And probably with 20 students, you'll see people from 12 different countries speaking, you know, 10 different languages. And when a class first starts, you find the students sit with other students who are from the same country or speak the same language that they do, but within a very short period of time, you see they begin to mix. They begin to talk to each other as they learn English, and we really become a community. I think people realize that there is much more that brings us together than tears us apart. A mother from any country worries about her children the same way. All of us want to make sure our children are healthy. All of us want to make sure our children do well in school. Parents worry about putting food on the table. So they see that there's much more that brings them together. So whether you're from Algeria or you're from China, there really are similarities.
I wonder,
the food is different. The culture is different.
Sure.
But the desire, but what makes us human is pretty much the same.
If I can just pursue the matter of differences for a moment, not to counteract in any way the absolute truth of what you just said, that, I mean, in the most fundamental sorts of ways, we all share the same sort of human desires for a fulfilling life and happiness with one another, of course. I am curious, though, on a little more kind of tangible level, that, for instance, when you or one of your teachers stands in front of such a diverse group, highly diverse group, and seeks to teach all of them English, are there particular difficulties that are associated with particular immigrants from particular ethnic groups? For instance, particular languages where we're talking about, in a sense, a much wider gulf to be crossed, or certain differences of maybe more of a cultural rather than language nature in which this process of learning English is especially difficult.
Certainly, if you come from if your first language doesn't have a similar alphabet, for example. So if you're from Israel or from the Middle East, it's from right to left as opposed to left to right, you know, the characters are different, might make it a little more difficult. But we have found that if someone is literate in his or her native language, they can read and write in his or her native language, they can pretty much pick up our alphabet, our sounds, our words. It's not that drastic. What we really have problems with is when you have someone who comes in and that person is illiterate in his or her native language. You know, we have some students, for example, who come from certain Middle Eastern countries that never permitted women to be educated. So we might have some women who are mothers, their children are in the public schools, and they're trying to learn English, and they're trying to learn to read and write. I'm thinking particularly of one woman from Afghanistan who came to this country because her husband had worked for the Americans, and he was killed. After he was killed by the Taliban, she had to escape with her four children. She had a brother in Pakistan. She got to Pakistan, and she eventually came to this country as a refugee. None of her children had ever been to school. She herself had never been to school because her father, her family, didn't believe in women being educated. And she was resettled in the city of Malden. Now, her two daughters went to who I think they were in fifth or sixth grade when they got here, had never been to school. She did not know a word of English, none of them. These two daughters today are in universities. One has a full scholarship at Bryn Mawr, and the other one is the University of Massachusetts in Boston, also on a full scholarship. And her other children are in high school. She herself has learned to read, write, and speak English. And she treasures that education. She just treasures it, hungered for it. So you might see that. And it is a difficult process if people don't have a background, if they're not literate in their native language, to learn a new language. Another example is a student from Haiti who from the time she was 6 years old was working in Haiti, never had an opportunity to go to school. She came to this country, she worked, she put her daughter through college, her daughter is a full-time nurse, and she herself learned English, and now she volunteers at the Immigrant Learning Center trying to help others. Mm. So, and of course, those are just individual stories. At the school, we've had over 7,300 students over the years. Each one has a story, an amazing story, Greg. So some people will find it more difficult to learn a new language than others. But we have techniques, we have ways of teaching languages.
We're speaking with Diane Portnoy, co-founder of the Immigrant Learning Center in Malden, Massachusetts, and one of the editors, along with her husband and Charlie Riggs, of a very interesting new book called Immigrant Struggles, Immigrant Gifts, which examines the long and extraordinary history of the experience of immigrants in the United States down through our history. By the way, Diane Portnoy, one thing you mention in the really poignant foreword to the book is that some of the folks who came to the Immigrant Learning Center experienced some very potent fears right after 9/11. And it's interesting, you don't go into great detail about that, but I think a lot of us heard something about that at the time, although I think most of us are grateful that there weren't more outbreaks of really serious incidents of violence, although there certainly were some. But something about the way you wrote about that really drove it home about what a frightening time that was, especially for immigrants and immigrants from all kinds of different places. Can you just say a quick word about that?
Yeah, well, exactly. What happened is after 9/11, our students were afraid to come to school because many of them experienced verbal abuse. So if they were walking down the street and they looked at all foreign, people would actually scream at them, go back, you know, you're a terrorist, go back to your own country. We don't want you here. We don't need you here. Go back. You know, my parents experienced that also. I remember my mother coming home once and telling me a story of how some people had said to her, too bad Hitler had not killed all the Jews, and it's a terrible thing that America let all these immigrants in after World War II. I saw the impact it had on her. I mean, she was very, very upset. Can you imagine? I knew the impact those comments were having on our students. And on top of that, people who knew what I was doing, the kind of work I did, would actually say to me, you know, Diane, the problem with this country is immigrants. And I would just look at it, you know, I was just shocked by that. And I realized there was this incredible increase, a dramatic increase, in anti-immigrant sentiment, rhetoric, and so much of it was based on misinformation, misunderstandings, stereotypes. And that's when I decided to start a public education program at the Immigrant Learning Center. And we have a public education institute. It's about 10 years old now. And one of the things the institute does is it commissions research that looks at immigrants as entrepreneurs, workers, and consumers, and the incredible impact it has on the economy of this country. Now, of course, we're in Massachusetts, so we looked primarily in Massachusetts. And as of last April, we partnered with George Mason University, which is in right out of Washington, D.C., and created an Institute for Immigration Research. So the research that we'll be doing now will be more national. We'll be looking at other communities as well, not just Massachusetts. But other people that have done research, as well as the research that we've done, it just clearly and dramatically shows the positive impact that immigrants have on the economy, especially as entrepreneurs. They are twice as likely to start a business than the native-born. And these entrepreneurs go on, they create jobs, they pay taxes, they buy goods and services, workers buy goods and services. So it has an incredibly positive impact on our communities. Now, small entrepreneurs, what they've done is they revitalize depressed communities and neighborhoods because they can't pay a lot of money for rent. So they'll go to these areas that have become very run down, and they'll rent some space, and suddenly they're sweeping in front of their store and putting flowers in the windows. And the next thing you know, another store opens, and these communities become revitalized. Then you have immigrant entrepreneurs that are sort of mid-level, they're growth businesses. And these people are really creating jobs and growing dramatically. And, of course, we have the technology companies. 25% of the technology companies in this country have an immigrant owner. 40% of Fortune 500 companies were started by an immigrant or the child of an immigrant. So we truly are a nation of immigrants. And I keep saying, you know, immigrants are good for the economy. Immigrants are good for the country. Immigrants are good for you. You know, the person living next door to you, they're good for you. They pay taxes also. Here in Massachusetts, they're 14% of the population, but pay 16% of the state income taxes. So they have a very, very positive impact. And we've been doing the research. We also hold teacher forums on immigration, and we have an information research website. So we try to get accurate information out there in response to all the negativity.
Hmm. Before we dig into the specifics of your book and the way in which it probes into our nation's history, I wonder if we could just, at least for a moment, address the matter of immigrants versus undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants.
I call them aspiring Americans.
Oh.
Okay, you like that? They're aspiring Americans.
Aspiring Americans.
The Americans.
That does put a bit of a different spin on it.
But I wonder if
you take a lot of time with that distinction, because, of course, that is a distinction that matters a lot to some people.
It is a very difficult political topic. There's no question about it. You have to remember there was a time in American history where we welcomed immigrants, especially during the 1860s and 1870s. And we went out of our way to get immigrants to come to this country. We needed them to build railroads and mines and canals and that sort of thing. States would actually go out and recruit immigrants. Michigan handed out free land. South Carolina offered immigrants 5-year tax exemption on real estate purchases. Texas sent agents all over to recruit immigrants, including Germans. So there was a time when immigrants were very, very welcomed. I don't think people realize that immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented, the research clearly shows that they generally do not take jobs away from the native-born. They're usually doing the kinds of jobs that the native-born choose not to do. Perhaps they're better educated. Those are not the kind of jobs that they want to do. Working on farms, for example, or picking apples or picking strawberries. So it is a serious problem. I don't think the country can ignore it. Are you asking my political opinion? No. You know, you have 11 million people. You really cannot ignore that. Do I believe that if we build a fence, people won't find a way to get here? If they're hungry and they want to feed their families, I think they'll find a way to help their families. And that's what makes immigrants especially special in my mind, is that they're willing to take a risk. And those are the kinds of things that have made America very special. Immigrants are needed in this country. The demographics are changing. We're getting older. People are having fewer children. We need people to replace jobs. We need people to create jobs. We need people to take care of the elderly, not as well as our children. So there is a very, very strong need in place for immigrants in this country, not to mention their skills and their ideas, and that adds to what goes on here. There's another thing also, Greg. People have this concept that the United States is this limited pie, that it's only so big and it can't grow anymore. When in reality, we are an expanding pie, and with more people and more workers, the economy actually grows. And so there is room for everybody. Now, what do we do about the undocumented? I think in reality, you cannot ignore the fact that there are these people in this country, many of whom are working and paying into the Social Security system, and they themselves will never see that money. We really do have to do something about that.
Most of your book, Immigrant Struggles, Immigrant Gifts, is taken up with an examination of various immigrant groups and a sketch of each history. And one of your co-editors, Charlie Riggs, in his introduction, almost to an extent sort of apologizes for that a little bit, the fact that it makes the book, in a sense, quite episodic. And yet, each of these histories, for all of the recurrent themes that we find, is its own unique story. And if one tried to tell the story of all of these immigrant groups sort of simultaneously, it would be all but impossible. I think whoever made the decision to structure the book as it is made a very good decision. I think it makes
you
a lot of sense.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, we decided to look at 11 different groups and how each one of those groups were exposed to nativism, kinds of things they experience, the anti-immigrant sentiment, rhetoric, some of it actually quite virulent, hangings, shooting, riots, and how each group overcame that, how they assimilated, how they integrated, and then how each group has gone on to make major contributions to this country. And we list people from various different ethnic groups that actually have made those contributions to this country, just as a small sample. So that's the theme that rides through the whole book. Regardless of the ethnic group, each one has gone through struggles, each one has overcome them, and each one has gone on to make some major contributions. And I think what we were thinking about is trying to create a book that could put into historical perspective the conversations we're having today about immigrants and immigration. Today we talk a lot about Mexicans or Muslims, for example, and you'll hear a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric against them. You know, everybody thinks Mexicans are all here undocumented and they're just coming to live on welfare. Or everybody thinks so many of those Muslims, the Middle Easterners, are terrorists. And the reality is very, very different. And there's no reason to believe that they are any different from those immigrant groups that have come here in the past. You know, Milwaukee, you have a strong German tradition. Am I correct?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
A large number of Germans. You have to realize there was a time when it was illegal to even use German, to speak German, to use German in the schools, although today I understand you have German schools, German language schools. Or you have a large Irish group in Milwaukee.
Yes.
And there was a time when there was something called the Know Nothing Party. Was very active in the 1850s. There's someone that even ran for president. It was very, very anti-Catholic, very anti-Irish, and anti-German, those Germans that were Catholic. So this, and look how much those groups have contributed to your communities. There is no reason to believe that the Mexicans or the Muslims or the more recent immigrants, whether they're Hmong or from Southeast Asia, are any different. It will be exactly the same. So I'm hoping we can put in some sort of perspective the fact that there really is nothing to fear from immigrants, that hopefully we can have some rational immigration reform in this country.
The very first chapter of the book actually focuses on German Americans, and
yeah.
I think it that is worth spending a little time on. It's written by someone named William G. Ross, and
correct.
He begins the chapter in riveting fashion with a story that of a Lutheran parochial school in Hampton, Nebraska. It's the year is 1920, and somebody bursts in from the government or law enforcement figure, actually the Hamilton County attorney, checking on whether or not class is being conducted in German.
Correct.
And the teacher on hand is defying those laws which had gone in place during the First World War. Say a little more about just how serious a situation this was. I mean, the kind of oppressive laws that had been put in place during the anti-German fervor of the First World War.
Yes, yes. Well, this particular case, the gentleman's name was Meyer, and he was actually teaching religion in German, in the German language, and that was part of the culture. People felt very strongly, the Germans felt very strongly at the time to understand the religion, had to be taught in German. And someone actually came into the classroom to check, someone from the government, and Meyer did it on purpose. He fought this on purpose. He chose to continue teaching in German. I mean, he could have switched to English because he wanted it to go to court. And, of course, the Supreme Court eventually decided that you do have the right to teach in other languages. But during World War I, there was a tremendous amount of anti-German sentiment. And it was, I think it was very difficult for the Germans because until that point they felt very much a part of the American culture, American society. They had brought a lot to this country from the concept of kindergarten, universal education for all children. They brought the idea of providing legal services to everybody, social services to everybody. They gym classes, you know, physical education should be part of education. So I think they felt very much a part of the country, and suddenly there was a real turning around. So even foods that had German names suddenly had to change the names to English names.
Mm.
So it was a difficult time.
Yeah,
and yeah.
Mr. Ross writes at one point, although they had suffered from many of the same prejudices, suspicions, and discrimination to which other immigrant groups were subjected throughout American history, German Americans had only rarely encountered virulent or violent hostility until World War I, since
right.
most were Protestant and lacked physical characteristics that distinguished them from the population at
right.
large. Relatively few encountered racial or religious discrimination, and also probably because they were the country's largest ethnic minority, numbering more than 8 million, the fact that suddenly all of this turned around so dramatically during the First World War had to make it, in a sense, even more painful versus that kind of prejudice which certain immigrants really lived with on a daily basis from the moment they set foot in our country. I mean, this was had to be such a jarring, painful experience for German Americans.
Yeah, I believe so. You know, I think even President Wilson at the time publicly exaggerated the extent of German American disloyalty. I think that's what people were afraid of. And he did eventually denounce mob violence, whatever. But I think it was a little, it came too late. It was too little.
No kidding. And I think one of the most interesting moments in this chapter is when Mr. Ross talks about a move in 1918 when the governor of Iowa, William L. Harding, mm-hmm. went even further than certain national laws, issuing a proclamation that prescribed English as the sole means of communication in all public places, including churches and over telephones. This at a time when operators...
And people would listen in over the phone.
Sure. And he goes on to say, although Harding later issued dispensations to some pastors of heavily German congregations, he declared in June of 1918, "There is no use in anyone wasting his time praying in other languages than English. God is listening only to the English tongue." I mean, it is really...
And we do have movements in this country that say English only. I mean, some things never change, Greg. There are people in this country that want to make English, quote-unquote, the official language, and that it shouldn't, no other languages should be used. Hmm. And there's a movement called English Only.
One of the consequences, evidently, of this kind of bigotry towards German Americans during the First World War, and of course it reasserted itself during the Second World War, I should think, to some extent, was that evidently German Americans became even more anxious to fully assimilate. German-American communities started really accentuating the American at the expense of the German part of the equation. And, of course, we really it's sad to think about culturally what was lost in that sort of bargain.
Yes. Well, I think you'll see it with all the groups that you read about historically. Some things get lost. Some things we hold on to, some things integrate. You know, I'd like to think we really are this big melting pot.
Mm.
And maybe people bring the best of all the cultures together, the best of all the foods, the best of... But immigrants are family-oriented people. That hasn't changed. They tend not to... I know there's a lot of talk about, oh, immigrants are criminals. Usually immigrant communities, not usually, the research clearly shows that communities where immigrants live, the crime rates go down. So the values that we hold dear in this country, are the immigrants have those same values.
Hmm. Of course, not far from where you are, and maybe even exactly where you are, there must be a large Irish population.
Well, and, with the city of Boston.
Yes.
Absolutely,
and,
yes.
And the second chapter of the book, the chapter is written by Anna Gressel Baccarin, examines the experience of Irish Americans. And you've already touched on the heavy bigotry that was part of the so-called Know-Nothing Party,
right,
which was so virulent in its attack on the Irish. There was all kinds of attitudes at play, but of course, very deeply embedded in anti-Irish sentiment was anti-Catholic sentiment.
Yes.
Can you just say a word about that and how that figured in the history of the Irish Americans?
Well, 1854, we had the Know-Nothing Party. It was also called the American Party, and it actually won a string of political victories, including the governor of Massachusetts at that time, Henry Joseph Gardner. And their platform was very anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, which of course meant anti-Irish. And they were described, the Irish were described as criminals or drunks. They all live on welfare. They're controlled by the Pope. They were believed to be diseased. Cholera was actually called the Irish disease. And there were a number of anti-Irish and Catholic riots there, even before that. In Boston, there were, I think there was one 1835, Philadelphia 1844, St. Louis 1854. You know, it goes on. Coalfield riots, the Coalfield riots in 1870s. So, and also there was a book published called, I don't know if you've heard of this, The Awful Disclosures of Maria Monk in 1836. She was supposedly a nun, and she wrote a book that talked about all the sexual activities that went on in the convent. Of course, it was proved false, but, I mean, it was very wide read. So there was this stereotype, this belief about the Irish, that, and a lot of prejudice that Irish had to experience at the time.
I want to say also that in this chapter, I especially appreciated one example of course, and the book's full of them, of immigrants who made a huge difference in our country's life, immigrants that many of us have never heard of. And in the Irish American chapter, special mention is made of an inventor by the name of Thomas Murray, who worked side by side with Thomas Edison.
Edison, that's right.
And of course,
that's
Thomas right. Edison has won all the headlines and is
that's
the name
right.
that trips off our tongue. But we so seldom remember that often there are folks just off of the spotlight who are nearly as crucial in the development of things that we take for granted every
right.
day in our modern lives.
Yeah, you know, this Thomas Murray was one of 12 children. His father died when he was 9. He had to quit school to light gas lamps in Albany, New York. But he went on to invent all sorts of things. He did work with Thomas Edison, and he went on to own major electric companies in New York City and many patents with Thomas Edison. You know, three people that signed the Declaration of Independence were Irish.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it goes way back. Andrew Jackson.
Wow.
He was a president elected in 1828. He was Irish.
Hmm.
So there's a long history with each one of these groups.
The Italian-Americans, we also need to talk about for just a moment, that there are many Italian immigrants in this neck of the woods. And, of course, that's part of a story that you're, to some extent, familiar with as well. I found the writer of this particular chapter doing a really good job of trying to tackle what I believe at one point he calls the persistence of the mafia mystique.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, this assumption that, of course, so many people make about Italian-Americans and the activity of groups like the mafia. I mean, it's a really interesting examination of that, and it helps us understand that sometimes there is a bit of fact rooted in with the myth, but that so often we let that those sort of ideas or images or overgeneralizations
right.
sort of carry the day past
right.
the point of it being useful at all in understanding a given
right.
ethnic group.
Yeah, we still see it in TV today. You know, we have stereotypes about various ethnic groups. But most Italians certainly are not criminals. Many have made incredible contributions. They have a vibrant culture and family life. Their food, everybody loves Italian food. But certainly they also suffered greatly and at the hands of people that were very anti-Italian, especially those that came from Sicily, from southern Italy. They and many lived in New Orleans, a large group of people there. They were believed to be sneaky and cowardly. There were all sorts of things. I believe the incident that we talk about at the beginning of that book is on October 15, 1890. In New Orleans, the chief of police was shot and died. And before he died, he blamed, quote-unquote, the Dagos. Hundreds of Italians were rounded up, 19 were indicted, 9 went to trial, but not convicted. It was really considered quite a scandal. And then on March 14th, 1891, a mob of over 100 broke into the jail and hung 11 of the Italians. And many of the newspapers okayed this act. They said, you know, this is something that should have been done. So that's just one simple example of what a particular ethnic group had to endure. But Italians, you know, like all the others, they did learn English, they did integrate, they assimilated, and then made wonderful, wonderful contributions to the country.
Mm. Your book goes on to examine the history of all kinds of other immigrant groups, including Muslim Americans, and we are reminded that that is a history that is not just from our own day. But there have been Muslim immigrants to the United States for many decades, and
of course,
that particular essay, of course, also examines some of the particular fears and issues that are part of current Muslims living here in America. I wanted to close by turning back to the introduction and talking about words that I'd never read before until I saw your book. Words spoken by our first president, George Washington.
George Washington.
This is what he said to a group of Irish immigrants, and I wonder if you would comment on it. He said to them in 1784 that the bosom of America is open to receive not only the opulent and respectable stranger, but the oppressed and persecuted of all nations and religions. It's amazing to me that words as beautiful as that and profound as that aren't better known.
I wish they were. The other quote also that we have in the front of the book is one by Grover Cleveland. Also talks about the importance of immigration. And then we go as recently as Ronald Reagan in his farewell address in 1989. Also talked about how this United States is a place that welcomes the oppressed, the poor. And we really are, this country really is a beacon of hope, an opportunity for so many.
And those quotations of Washington, Cleveland, Reagan, those three presidents span so much of our history.
Yes.
And it really underscores the fact that our history is in so many ways an immigrant history.
It is an immigrant history. Yes, we are a nation of immigrants.
And the book, again, is called Immigrant Struggles, Immigrant Gifts. And the book created under the auspices of the Immigrant Learning Center, published by GMU Press, and one of its editors, Diane Portnoy. Diane Portnoy, I'm so glad that we had this chance to speak about this very interesting and important book. Thank you so much, and thank you for the good work you do.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of the UEC, the United Environmental Council, with Nan Calvert. Tomorrow also we'll be joined by Jane Herring, David Rhodes, and Sister Janet Weicker to talk about the upcoming EcoFest. On Wednesday, you'll be meeting jazz pianist Kenny Werner. The Kenny Werner Trio is performing at the University of Wisconsin Parkside on Thursday evening, and Kenny Werner is also leading a masterclass Thursday afternoon as part of UW Parkside's Jazz Week. On Thursday, you'll hear my conversation with one of the most important contemporary opera composers, Jake Heggie, also a composer of magnificent art songs. The Milwaukee Florentine right now is doing his chamber opera called Three Decembers. And on Friday, you'll hear from Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Today is going to be a cloudy and mild day with a 30% chance of some scattered showers, a high of 53 degrees inland, cooler near the lake. Cloudy and mild overnight with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy with a 70% chance of rain, a high tomorrow of 57 degrees, again a little cooler near the lake. We should have sunshine by Wednesday and a high once again of about 57 degrees.